now.
They're locking us in now. Okay, that's better. My name is Michael Waslick. My co-panelist is Anitra Pavka. We're here to present Targeting Your Website Accessibility Litigation Update. I want to tell you a little bit about ourselves, why we're here, why we think we're qualified to talk to you about this thing today. And we will, after we do that, we're going to find out a little bit about you, and then we're going to launch into some of the meat of our presentation. We hope to have plenty of time for Q&A, so I hope you guys brought questions, and hopefully we brought the answers for you. A little bit about myself. Again, my name is Michael Waslick. I'm an attorney based out of Florida. I am not necessarily an accessibility expert. I am a litigator, and I'm aware of the impact that cases can have on the way the law evolves and how it applies to those who work in the internet, those who work in business, and those who rely on stability in the law to make very important decisions for how they're going to proceed. I am a web enthusiast. I do handle a number of different internet-related legal issues. Most recently, I've been handling copyright cases arising out of file-sharing lawsuits, but those obviously are very internet-related. But today, my prime focus is going to be on the law as it has changed and evolved over the last several years to apply to websites, in particular those that are owned and operated by your businesses. Anitra?
All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Anitra Pavka, and I have, of course, a variety of hats in the jobs I've done over the past 2 years, but I've done, you know, web accessibility, usability, design, a lot of front-end work, and I got into web accessibility back around 2001 when I was working for a company that had a contract with the state of Kansas. So we were working on creating websites and applications that had to adhere to both state guidelines as well as we adhere to federal guidelines. And that got me really interested in kind of the guidelines, the technology, and what should be done around that. And I've been following that over the past many years, I guess, and kind of keeping up with that. And so I'm going to cover more of the technology side of it, of the websites, and of course Mike covers the legal.
All right, before we get started, we'd like to ask a little bit about who the audience is so that we can make sure that the scope of today's presentation addresses some of the things that you're looking at. How many people in the audience are business owners or decision makers in businesses here today? Okay, we got a few hands up. How many of you are web designers, web professionals in any capacity that have clients that are private business? The vast majority of you. So we're going to try and give you information that you need to be able to take back to your clients and make the business case and the legal case for why it matters for you to be accessible in the private sphere, why it matters what the benefits are, what the consequences are if you fail, you know, not just the moral case, but the business and the legal case, what the consequences are if you fail to meet those guidelines, and how to handle the uncertainty of the evolution of the law as it goes forward. Do any of you have experience working with government websites, 508 criteria? Okay, good. That's about half the room. We're not going to specifically address 508 as it applies, but using that, using the tools you've learned from applying 508 requirements mm-hmm. to the websites you've already developed is going to give you a better sense for where you need to be going on in the future. The criteria, by and large, are going to be the same in terms of what compliance is going to be required mm-hmm. if you fall within the scope of the law, and even if you don't. And we're going to start addressing some of that. So the first question, why worry about accessibility? Why does it matter? A lot of business owners, a lot of your clients are going to want you to be able to tell them, you know, why should I spend money bothering to be accessible? I'm not, you know, it's only a tiny fraction of the people on the web is the popular misconception among a lot of business owners. And that's not necessarily true, first of all. But the second reason is that the cost of noncompliance can be very, very high. How many of you have already heard about one of the cases we're going to be talking about today, which is the Target case where the NFB sued Target? Okay, that's about, I'd say, about 80% of the room. That case involves, just very briefly background, we'll get into more detail later, the National Federation of the Blind has a federal lawsuit against Target Corporation, because alleging that their website's not accessible. That case is currently pending in federal court in California. It's been going on for almost 2 years now, and Target's first response was, you know, we don't need to comply with this law. We're just going to go ahead and ask the judge to throw it out, and the judge disagreed. And they have been forced to spend quite a bit of money defending themselves in federal court. And the very short answer for the business case is it's cheaper to be accessible in most cases than it is to be a defendant. And even up to the point where you are asking a judge to throw it out at the motion to dismiss stage, even getting to that point can be prohibitively expensive and can probably, in most cases, be avoided if you spend a fraction of that just getting to the point where you're not going to be a target for accessibility lawsuits, where you have satisfied your users, where you have made a point of incorporating your users' comments and being involved and not being a target.
No pun intended.
Yeah, no. Well, we're gonna be making that pun all day long. So brace yourselves, buckle your seatbelts in. And I know it's dumb, but we're gonna do it anyway. To give you a sense of the volume of the legal work in this case, so far up to date, and actually this is through the beginning of February, the docket on this case is 24 pages. Now, the docket is just a list of all the legal briefs and papers that have been filed in the case. That's 24 pages long. There have been 174 documents filed in the case in total, and that's everything from the initial complaint all the way through to affidavits and legal briefs and motions and what have you. And that includes, of course, the class action certification. This is a class action lawsuit. Effectively, Target is being sued by, in effect, every blind person in the United States who's tried to use their website. They've got eight very expensive lawyers, eight on the case. There's probably more than that working on the case, from one of California's most expensive law firms, a firm named Morrison & Foster. And you can go to their website, which is mofo.com. They pride themselves on that, by the way. Yep. Now, the average mofo bills out about between $200 and $400 an hour, and just through the motion to dismiss stage, which was document number 5, by the way, just through the very earliest stage of the lawsuit, 2 to 3 months into it, it's very easily they spent 100 lawyer hours getting to that point. And do the math. You know, already at that point, very early in the case, they've spent, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. The cost, the total cost of defending this case, if they win, okay? Now, mind you, they've lost the motion to dismiss stage, the early gatekeeping phase. This is going all the way through. They've had the class action certification. So they're now doing a lot of legal work. It is not impossible that they will spend millions and millions of dollars just defending this case if they are successful. If they were to settle this case at some point, and I imagine that at some point they will try to do that, they will likewise spend millions and millions of dollars, not only in their own legal fees, but the other side's legal fees. There will be some funds involved, payments of compensation to the class, to the members of the class, the blind folk who have been included in the class, and also, too, the cost of actually complying with the settlement, which will almost certainly involve doing what they might have done in the first place, which is implement those accessibility measures that the NFB had asked them to do. And that's kind of the settlement's kind of the middle case scenario. The worst case scenario is if they lose. And that is, you know, it's impossible to estimate what that is. Again, we're talking millions of dollars, possibly, you know, possibly even in the billion-dollar range, if depending on how things were to work out. So clearly, getting sued is a bad idea. You know, anybody in the room disagree about that? Okay, because if you are, we'll leave a card here, and I'll talk to you later. So you don't want to get sued. How much, though, would it cost to fix the loss, to fix the website, to implement some of the changes that are needed to make this website accessible? You know, really, we're talking about a tiny fraction. You know, this is the alternative, of course, to fixing it is paying for these expensive mofos. But if you look at, you know, this is kind of a graphical representation, and these are really just ballpark because every case is going to be different. When you're dealing with a company the size of Target, obviously you're talking about millions of dollars to have the lawyers resolve it, and you're talking about a tiny fraction of that to have your web folks resolve the problem. You know, in terms of the types of changes that need to be made on the website, really, you know, even if you're the highest paid web professionals in the world, aren't going to charge them nearly as much as the lawyers that they're paying to defend this. So this is just kind of a visual determination for those who are listening along the podcast. You know, we've got a chart up with four bars, basically an estimate of about $20 million just to settle the case, perhaps $5 million for a successful defense if they get it thrown out at some later stage. And that's, by the way, not including appeals, which there would inevitably be if they don't settle it. Whereas with the web workers, either doing a complete redesign or even just tweaking the existing website to make sure that it's compliant, you know, we're talking about far less than $1 million, maybe a few hundred thousand for a large website the size of Target. Now, many of you probably have small business clients. How many of you have small business clients in the room? Okay. Any of you deal with companies the size of Target? Okay. Good. There's a good show of hands for each one. So for the big companies, I mean, you can take this chart to them and show it to them, and you know, if you want to. But the numbers are astronomical in terms of getting sued, but they are much less in terms of just the cost of fixing it. And you and your clients can figure out exactly what it is, what kind of budget you're looking at to make some of these changes. And we'll go through some of the specific changes a little bit later on in the panel. But the cost of being sued, they can certainly talk to their own lawyers. For the small businesses, the magnitude is going to change a little bit, but still the relative cost of fixing a website for a small person, for a sole proprietorship, for example, who's got maybe a 5-page website, the cost of fixing that, I could do that in a day, and I'm not a web professional, but the cost of fixing that is going to be much less than having to pay a lawyer to defend it. And of course, that's not the end of the business case. Besides just the relative cost of paying your lawyers to defend a lawsuit, whether you are successful or not, there's also the cost of not being accessible to your potential business, customers. I'm sorry, to your customers. If you're having a website, it's because you are trying to reach your customers in some way, shape, or form. I'm going to let Anitra talk a little bit about the statistics of the web audience that we're thinking about.
Yeah. Another thing that while we're discussing the case is to really understand what the size of the audience is and who's being impacted here. So I found some just general sort of statistics that across the world, about 10% of the population has some form of disability. It could be anywhere from severe to mild. It's the world's largest minority group. So in other words, it's not just a small number to be reckoned with. And when we say disabled, you know, there's the variety of different disabilities. In the case of Target, they're really looking at blind. But when you say blind, that's not the only type of visual disability. You have low vision, so in other words, you can't really see as well. You have tunnel vision. You even have things like color blindness, where, you know, looking at certain colors together, you can't distinguish between them. And then, of course, there's other types of disabilities that weren't necessarily brought up regarding the Target case. You have things like hearing disabilities, so, you know, hardness of hearing, deafness. But then at the same time, someone who would be, you know, someone who might have a hearing disability, someone who doesn't have speakers set up on their computer would be in the same situation. So it's, you have to look at it as, you know, a larger group of affected people. And then, of course, you have some of the other disabilities, things like motor skills, different capabilities, in which case they might use different types of input devices to be able to access your website. And then also there's the more complex things like learning and cognitive disabilities. But as I said, really for this case, we're focusing in on the visual disabilities. And that's where I got some more specific statistics about in the U.S. So in the U.S., there's about 10 million visually impaired. And of those, the estimates are anywhere between about 1.5 to 3 million who actively use the internet. That estimate's a little rough just because the 1.5 million was estimated back in 1999. And of course, a lot has changed since then. I mean, a lot more people are on the web as well as the disabled. So that's why the estimates, we generally just try to double it and say it's about 3 million. It actually could be more at this point. It's really hard to judge. And then more specifically in California, where this case is being held, we have 140,000 who are visually impaired and about 10,000 who use the internet. So that just kind of gives you the general scope in the U.S. as well as in California, which is also a subset of the class that's in the lawsuit.
Now, when we talk about the law, the disability law here in the United States, some of you have already said that you're familiar with Section 508, but there's basically two specific sources of disability law that I want to talk to about that are important. In the statutes, there's two acts. One is the Rehabilitation Act of 1974, and the other is the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. Now, both of those acts were passed before the web really even existed in the form we know it today. And so neither one of them, either intentionally or otherwise, encompassed the World Wide Web. None of them encompassed websites as something that needed to be considered as accessible. Now, the difference between 508 and the ADA, the ADA, I'm talking specifically about Title III here, which is the what will apply to private businesses, is Section 508 is for government and government services. So if you work for a government contractor, for example, that's interacting with the public or interacting with government employees, you're going to need to meet those 508 requirements. Now, with the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title III provides for what are called places of public accommodation. And what exactly does that mean? Again, generally speaking, those are going to be the types of private businesses we're talking about, and I'm going to get into a little bit more detail later. But in terms of whether those are websites or not, the Rehabilitation Act was amended in 1998, and that was amended to include electronic and information systems, which expressly by the term that incorporates websites into 508 requirements, which is why it's a popular topic here at this conference. And so if you're working on a government website or a government-related website, 508 is going to apply to your website, and so you're going to have to make sure that that website is accessible to your disabled users. But there's a lot of confusion about the ADA, whether or not it applies to websites in the private sphere. And the reason for that is because back in 1998, when Congress amended the Rehabilitation Act and implemented 508 as we know it today, they considered and rejected some of those same amendments to the ADA. So at that time, from 1990 forward, there was a lack of clarity as to whether or not the ADA applied to websites in the private sphere. And the default answer was, no, it probably doesn't, but it should. There are a lot of legal commentators who thought it should be applied that way, but it wasn't really very clear. One of the reasons for that is because the way the ADA applies its own scope. Now, we're talking about Title III. Many of the types of civil rights laws, like the ADA, have a size provision, have a threshold for what size business it applies to. Now, Title III doesn't. It applies to a particular class of place. In this case, it's public accommodations. Now, you can see I've got 12 listed up here. These are the 12 categories that are in the statute, and I've paraphrased them a little bit, but they're pretty true to what the statute actually says. You can see from looking these over, we're looking at hotels, motels, places of lodging, restaurants and bars, a movie theater, an auditorium. I'm going to skip over those two, terminal depot or transportation station, museums, libraries, galleries, those types of places. And also, too, I'm going to go back to those two I skipped over because they're important when we're talking about this. They're probably the bulk of what we're talking about. Retail sales or rental stores, and that's how Target stores, their brick-and-mortar stores, are brought into the ADA. It's why their physical stores have to be compliant. And also retail services, barbers, banks, lawyers, accountants. My law office has to be accessible. It's a place of public accommodation when I have clients in. So it's generally speaking, judges who have looked at this part of the law have considered the application of Title III to be physical spaces that are open to the public. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean a physical space that's not open to the public. So if you have a, if you are a web designer and you have a physical space, a place where you do work, you know, an office in your attic or something like that, but you never have clients there, that's probably not going to be a public accommodation. But if you do have clients or customers come into a place where you do business, that is probably going to fall within the definition of public accommodation. But again, the statute clearly talks about a public accommodation being a physical space, and that's going to be important in the way judges have interpreted that requirement. Up until 2002, there was uncertainty about whether the ADA applied to websites offered by private businesses. And the first case to talk about whether a website fell within the ADA scope happened in 2002 in Florida. And it's a case that many of you may have heard of, Access Now Incorporated versus Southwest Airlines. And Access Now was a group that advocated on behalf of the disabled. And Southwest Airlines is probably the way most of you got here to this panel today. It's the way I got here. Southwest Airlines had one of the first websites for airlines. It allowed you to buy tickets online, and nowadays you can even print out your boarding pass. But in 2002, that was pretty novel for an airline to have a website to the scope it did, and it wasn't accessible. At least according to I haven't looked at it, but the challenge was that it wasn't accessible. Now, when that case was filed, again, that was down in Miami, and it was a case, what they call a case of first impression. Nobody else had considered the matter before about whether the website was incorporated. And the judge in this case, at a very early stage, the motion to dismiss stage, which is where they consider the very first complaint that's filed and determine whether or not it falls within scope, the judge said no. The ADA does not apply to this website that Southwest has for a couple different reasons. First of all, the judge looked at those 12 categories that we just saw a few minutes ago and said, well, Southwest's website is not a physical place. It is not a place where its customers, you know, are invited to gather. They can't physically be in on the website. So it doesn't fall within those 12 categories. The other aspect of it is that the ADA applies to the services provided by the public accommodation. And so the court looked at to see whether the services provided through the website had a what they call a nexus, a connection to a physical space that is incorporated in those 12 categories. Now, what's interesting is this case probably turned on a loophole in that aircraft are specifically exempted from those 12 categories. Now, we talked about how the transportation centers are actually listed there, but aircraft, presumably because they're regulated by the FAA, were not included in the ADA. And so, you know, had that answer been different, we might be having a different conversation here today. But when the Southwest case came down, the public perception was that, oh, well, the Southwest case says that websites don't have to be accessible under the ADA. And, you know, I think now we can look back at that and say that was an overgeneralization. That was a too broad interpretation of what they were saying. But a lot of people perceived it to be that way in 2002. Now, the Target case that's recently been filed, or that is currently pending, rather, applies that same determination about whether or not there's a public accommodation, whether or not there's a nexus to the services, and comes out with a very different answer than the Southwest case, because the facts are a little bit different. First of all, I think it's clear that the Target stores, the physical stores themselves, are a place of accommodation. They're a retail store. It's one of the prime categories under the public accommodation definition. There's really no debate about whether the stores are an accommodation. Even Target doesn't say they're not. One of the arguments that Target raised is that, well, even if our stores are an accommodation, the discrimination that they're alleging is not happening in the stores. It's on the website. It's out there in the ether space of the internet, and that's not covered in the ADA because it's not in the store. And the court disagreed with that. The court said, no, that's not. It doesn't have to happen on site to be covered. That's not what the statute says. It merely has a requirement that the services that are linked to, connected to, the public accommodation be non-discriminatory, be fully accessible to the disabled. The other issues that the court looked at, one of the contentions that Target raised was that the ADA only applies to websites which govern physical access to the stores. In other words, and that relies on some case law, the Rendon case, which I will talk about in a minute. But the idea that the services provided at the website, because it was not the means by which people found the stores, was somehow not going to be related service. The court rejected that argument, saying that the service doesn't have to be the only way people get to the stores. It just has to be something that's reasonably related to the purpose of the store itself, and relied on the statutory language, which says that the services offered have to allow the quote full participation, the full enjoyment rather, of the services offered by the covered public accommodation, and that because because Target.com, the Target's website, the access that disabled users, in this case the blind, was unequal, it deprived them of the full enjoyment of the goods and services offered at the stores. Mm-hmm. And so based on that, the court said, well, we're not going to throw out this lawsuit. We believe that the ADA applies, and we're going to allow this case to go forward. Now, one of the questions that comes up under the ADA is, what if I've offered a reasonable accommodation? And that's actually a pretty good defense. If you say your website is, maybe the plaintiff has said it's not accessible, but you say, well, I've taken these reasonable measures to make sure the website's accessible. Well, that's an affirmative defense, and what that means is that's something that if you were to go to court and prove, a jury would be able to say, yeah, you're fine. We'll bring back a zero verdict. Well, the problem is to get to that point, you have to go all the way through trial. And so then we're looking at the question of how much you're going to have to pay your lawyers to get there. So generally speaking, although you can say you've made a reasonable accommodation, it's usually a better idea to craft your website in such a way to reduce dissatisfaction among potential plaintiffs, as well as improving actual access and reasonable alternatives. Now, in terms of what they have talked about being wrong with the website, there are a number of specific allegations in the case, and what we're going to do here is we're going to mention them briefly, and we're going to take a look at the website itself. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn it over to Anitra now to talk about some of the things that are not proper with the Target website that create barriers to the accessibility for the blind.
So just to give you a little bit more background on how the case came into being, so the National Federation of the Blind had a member in California who came to them and said, hey, I'd like to try to shop at Target, but one of the things that he does is he likes to pre-shop. He likes to try to find the circulars, specifically online through Target.com, and to try to find out what items are there so he can create a list because of his visual disability, he has to have an assistant, otherwise help him. And it just makes it easier if he already has everything laid out. And he couldn't get to some of these things that he wanted to do. He couldn't do his pre-shopping. He couldn't, there are services like you can order online and pick things up in the store. He couldn't do any of that. And those were services that were an extension of the store. And so he went to the National Federation of the Blind and he said, hey, can you help me out? Let's work with Target. Let's see what we can do. So the National Federation of the Blind met with Target. They were in discussions for several months. And Target finally said, no, we're really not going to make all the changes you want. And that's really how this case came about. And so that's what I'm going to cover now are what was covered in the complaint. So what were the specific things that Target didn't do that they should have done to avoid the lawsuit? And one thing you might notice is if you do check out Target's website, some of these things have been changed. I'll mention some of them as I go through them. But you'll also be able to tell pretty easily not all of them have been fixed, and that's why it's still pending. So just in general, the blind user, John, was using a screen reader called JAWS. It's one of the more popular ones, very common. And that was kind of the basis of the complaint. It wasn't accessible for him in JAWS. He couldn't hear everything that was presented to any other user as the page was read to him. He couldn't navigate around easily, and he couldn't even complete the checkout process, at least not by himself. So one of the biggest problems was the classic problem of including alt text. And I won't go on in too much depth, but pretty much product pictures of the product, or even things like if you use an image instead of just a normal form submit button, if you make a nice little image that says checkout or something like that, there was no alt text to say what that did. So because you used an image to replace the normal form elements, you didn't know where to check out. You didn't know exactly what the picture was of. And probably one of the biggest problems was image maps. So you have one large image, and you have different pieces of that image that has, say, links to different areas. And all of those links, you didn't know where they went. Because there was no alt text on that area of the image map, there was, in essence, no name for the link. All you had was a really cryptic link name that usually, you know, it was something that would be generated, so it'd have 13 different nonsensical letters, and it'd be 5 miles long, and it just wouldn't make sense. So trying to navigate around was just a nightmare, just due to the lack of alt tags. Of course, there was also other navigational problems. One thing that was not very well pretty much the page itself wasn't well structured. It was missing headings. And one thing that I'm not sure if everyone's aware is that a lot of the screen reading software uses headings to help people navigate around easily. It's pretty much like jumping to a section, like in a book, or, you know, pretty much, you know, okay, this is, you know, maybe a navigation, this is, you know, this department, and it allows you to very easily go to where you want to go and what otherwise might be a really long list of things you'd have to listen to everything. And Target, even to this day, doesn't use headings correctly. So being able to use those to get around, very difficult. They also have problems like just simple things like tab order. So you're using your keyboard, and Target, up until fairly recently, this was one thing they fixed, you had to use your mouse at certain points. But a blind person, I mean, a mouse is a visual input device. You have to be able to see where the cursor is. And so the lack of keyboard, kind of, you know, just making sure that the keyboard's available as an option really inhibited people from using the site as well as from checking out. So it was just like telling them, you have to have a mouse to buy from us. It's a requirement. So as I said, making sure that you can use the keyboard to access all the functionality is really, really critical.
What we're going to do now is show you a little bit about, and these are just images right now. We can go to the website directly if we need to, but this is what the Target.com website looks like with images enabled. So most of the people in the room, if you are visually enabled, you know, with normal vision, you can see and navigate around this website probably pretty well. But a screen reader doesn't see these images. A screen reader won't know how to make sense of these unless there are the proper accommodations built in, like alt tags, like headers and the things that Anitra's been talking about, as well as proper labeling of form buttons and the like. Here's what it looks like without images. Now, if you notice, if you flip back and forth between these two, you can see up at the top there's a pretty big menu bar up there. That apparently is an image map, and there's no labeling on the image map at all. There's another one down the side here. So if you look at the top, the side, and then the area where the merchandise is being displayed, and then I'm going to flip back to the without images. Mm-hmm. And you can see that all that information has disappeared.
And for your reference, I'm sure folks of you who are familiar with search engine optimization are also realize that this is pretty much what Google sees. Google can't see the images. Search engines can't see the images. Therefore, if you don't have the alt text, if you don't have the textual equivalents, then they have nothing to index. They have nothing to register with the site. So all the blank areas, that's what they see.
Yeah, if Google can't see your website, then chances are neither can your disabled users. So, and odds are you want both of them to see. So, you know, the question then is Target.com, you know, is their website enabled? And this is just, by the way, this is what we've just shown you. This is just one of many, many, many examples that we could find with Target's website if we wanted to go through and spend all day long, which we don't. This was the other day.
Yep.
This was what is today, Monday? So that was probably Saturday. Yeah. If we pulled it up live, it would look almost exactly like this, except that the merchandise that they're displaying today has changed. But that's a good question. Thank you. The question for those who couldn't hear it was how long ago were the images that we're using changed, the illustrations, and these were captured on just 2 days before today. So does Target's website meet accommodation requirements? I don't think so. I think they fail. Some of the other cases that have dealt with accessibility issues, the ADA, specifically Title III, the private business aspect of it, that were relied on by the Target Court. I've got three of them up here. One at Rendon versus Valley Crest Productions. And that one was also a 2002 case, and that was out of Florida as well. And that one was probably, that may have been the best known and the most compelling case for a website being accessible. That case involved, if you guys remember the game show, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? And if you remember how you qualified to be on that game show, it was you had to dial in and do your fast finger test when you answer the questions and you're timed. And the only way to get onto the game show as a participant was to go through this telephone screening process. And, well, that clearly raised an accessibility problem for those who were either deaf or had a motion impairment, who couldn't dial fast enough. And so there obviously a lawsuit resulted, and the court said that the use of the telephone access to get into the game show raised ADA concerns and brought it within the scope of the ADA because the telephone access was a service that was used to gain access to the physical place of accommodation, which was the studio the game show was held. So the public accommodation in that case was the television studio, and the telephone service, the telephone access that they were using was a service related to that public accommodation. And that was a case that was relied on by Target to say, well, we don't have to have our website accessible because it's not the only way to get to our stores. And the court rejected that argument. But I think it's pretty clear to say that when you've got the physical place, in this case the television studio, having that service that is clearly has that close connection to the services that are offered there triggers ADA liability in that case. One of the other cases the court considered was the Ford versus Sharing Plow Corporation, and that's a Third Circuit case out of the Northeast. And in that case, it was a question of whether employment benefits offered by an employer were a service that was related to a public accommodation. In that case, the court said that there was no evidence that there was a sufficient connection, no nexus there, and said that was not a service that was related to the public accommodation. The last case is also a very interesting one, and it demonstrates the importance of the connection between the services and the accommodation. And Stoughton Borough versus National Football League out of the Sixth Circuit, in 1995. In that case, that was one of the earliest cases under the ADA, by the way. The challenge service there was a live telecast of a National Football League game. In that case, the plaintiffs alleged that the public accommodation was the stadium. And the court said that there was not a sufficient connection between the stadium and the service because the stadium was owned by somebody other than the NFL, and the service, the telecast, was being provided by the NFL, so that there wasn't that sufficient connection. And so that was an important case to illustrate the connection requirement, and it's why in the Target case, where you've got both the service and the accommodation being owned by the same company, that is something that demonstrates a sufficient nexus to bring it within Title III scope. So the takeaway from that analysis is, is your business or your business clients exposed to liability under the ADA if your website's not accessible enough? The answer is maybe. Like every lawyer, I'm going to say that it depends. But the rule of thumb is that if you have a brick and mortar place of business, if you have a place where you invite your clients or customers in, and you have a website that it has a sufficient connection to what's going on in that place, then you're probably going to be covered. Now, I've got some examples here on the screen of companies that are online only versus ones that have brick and mortar stores. You can see, for example, Amazon.com sells books on the web. There's no place, there's no physical place that they invite the public into. They may have a warehouse somewhere, but they don't invite their customers into a store. They're probably not implicated. They're probably not covered by ADA requirements under Title III. But Borders Bookstores, which has stores all over the country, they have a website and they have stores. There's no doubt in my mind that the ADA applies to their website as this case would be applied, as the Target case would be applied. You know, a company like 37 Signals, which does, you know, which offers services, you know, Basecamp and whatever else they have, you know, planning around your business. They're web only. They don't invite you in to their office. But, you know, if you were to go buy a Franklin Covey personal planner somewhere, they do have stores across the country. And so if their website's not accessible, I'm not saying any of these websites are inaccessible, but just using them as examples of whether they would be covered. But their website would need to be accessible because they have the brick and mortar stores. And you got Dell, you know, selling online primarily. I'm not sure that's still true, but you know, versus Apple, which has Apple stores all over the country, definitely something that's going to be related. They sell their merchandise through their websites and drive traffic to their stores. Now, one of the interesting things about the Nexus test is that in this case, we have the Target website offered a couple different features which created that Nexus. And in this case, you know, there's two real obvious ones. One is that they have the store locator on there. And that provided a means for people to access to find where their stores were. If you could go to the website, punch in your zip code and say, oh, there's a store near me over here. And that's clearly designed to promote the services that are being provided in the store. The second thing that they have, which helps cement that nexus, and there's probably many more, we could go through it all day long if we wanted to, is that you can go to Target's website, order merchandise online, and then go pick it up at the store. So the website is a means for them to sell things that are provided at the store. So there's absolutely an ironclad nexus there, and those are some of the things that the court considered in determining that connection was there. So what are some of the things you can do to minimize your exposure? Well, first, get proactive. If you have a website now, test it. Anitra can talk about the specific guidelines that are going to be applicable, the testing suites you may be able to use. But test it. Educate yourself about what type of standards are going to apply to make sure that you need to be accessible, that your website's users can enjoy the full participation in the services that you're providing. Involve disabled users in a conversation. In the Target case, they talked for months and months and months about what Target could do to make their website more accessible. Why Target chose not to or felt they were unable to, I can't say. I don't have an answer to that question. I can only think that there must have been some kind of legacy system built in there that they thought would be more expensive than paying their legal team to defend it. I think they might reconsider that now, but now that they are a test case. But involve disabled users from the start. Let those people tell you what they need and see if you can implement it. And the third thing is design accessibly from scratch. So if you're building a website from the ground up, bake those right in. Make sure that you're considering accessibility problems from day one. And be responsive. If you've already got a website up, make sure that you take your feedback seriously. If users are giving you feedback, definitely do something about it. If you have problems, fix them as quickly as you can. And if you can't fix them, offer equal alternatives. Now, I want to caution you about that, is that they have to be equal. If they're separate but unequal, then you're not gonna be in compliance with the ADA. Now, what does that mean? Again, the answer is it depends. Has that been litigated for websites? Has a judge come down and said what is and is not an equal alternative? Unfortunately, no. We're going to be largely in the dark on that. But there are some very clear guidelines to what is accessible for a website. What is the kind of the image of what an ideal website would look like, and how close you can get to that. The closer you can get, the better off you'll be. Do you want to talk about the guidelines?
I think I'll just touch back a little bit on just going through and just kind of testing. I'm sure as you know, there's a variety of different toolbars and testing suites and automated things out there. Like one of my favorites right now is the Firefox accessibility extension. And then the nice thing is, you know, Firefox is across different platforms, so it's not dependent on Mac or Windows. But one of the big things is, especially if you already do usability testing, if your client is, you know, a large website and they want to make sure that their software, you know, their site's usable, is to make sure just as part of the normal process, you try to recruit users with different types of disabilities. I've personally even gone to, there's usually, you can get people pretty easily from like one of the state schools. There's, you know, schools for the blind, for the deaf, things like that. And at least based on my own personal experience, assuming you don't need it overnight, they're usually more than thrilled to try to give some form of feedback on a site that you're currently working on. They just really like to feel engaged, involved, and you get some of the best feedback just that way in person. In fact, I can say for sure that, you know, even someone with a disability, as they're going through it, they'll hit usability issues that will affect everyone. So it's really just part of the usability testing process.
Okay. Now, up on the screen, I've got some of the things that Anitra and I have talked about as potential accessibility fixes. And if you've taken the time to learn about accessibility, a lot of these are going to be self-evident. I looked at my watch a minute ago, and I want to leave some time for Q&A, so I want to go ahead. We can, if you all want to talk specifically about that, we can go back to that. But I will tell you that that there's accessibility is not a, you know, 1 hour session. It's not a quick fix. It's not a product you can buy. It's something that it's a process that you have to involve yourself in and educate yourself about. I mean, these are all certainly measures you can take. Using alt tags and using headings, identifying headings. Explicitly label your forms, all those things that you can learn about here at South by Southwest. We have numerous panels every year on accessibility. So educate yourself about accessibility. If you're the web designer, if you're the person making the website, make sure you understand what the target is. And if you don't feel like you can educate yourself, make sure that you have access to somebody who can help you with that. And if you're a business owner, same thing. If you're going to use a technology, you need to understand what it is.
And one thing that's really key is it also depends on what you're using to really implement the site. You know, is it going to be Ajax heavy? Is it going to be just a pretty simple, you know, HTML and style sheet sort of website? So just making sure that you have the fundamental ideas of what you need to include, and then defining, okay, how do I make sure I do that given the different technologies I'm using?
Yeah, there are widely accepted measures for just about any kind of technology you're going to use on the web. I mean, everything from plain HTML to Flash, video, yeah. Audio. There are definitely techniques that are, you're not fumbling around in the dark. People have gone there before you, and there are techniques that you can use for each technology that you want to implement. And before you implement a particular technology, you're going to want to make sure that you understand what accessibility measures are going to be needed for that technology. Some of the benefits of making sure you're accessible.
So, you know, you have the obvious, just the moral case. It's really the right thing to do. You're taking what already exists in the technology, and you're just really using it correctly. You're taking advantage of what already exists. But, more along the lines of maybe a business case, you have things like you're increasing your customer base. As I mentioned, you know, millions of users in the U.S. on the internet have some form of disability, and that way you can tap into that audience. And then, of course, on the flip side, you know, if you don't do that, you get the bad PR, things like that. So you're avoiding the boycotts, you're avoiding the bad PR by doing pretty much the right thing. You're also, as I mentioned, improving usability generally for a wider base of users. Also, that means your websites will tend to be accessible and usable across a wider variety of input devices, which could be, you know, any range in the mobile. It could be, you know, any desktop, different platforms. So it really, you know, just broadens the scope of your website. And then also, as we mentioned, it improves your search engine rankings usually, or at least the ability to improve your search engine rankings, because it adds in things that the search engine can see. the text, the, you know, things like that. It also, of course, you know, while we're here, it also allows you to avoid the liability, the lawsuits, the legal aspect.
Accessibility is cheaper than lawyers. Okay. The last thing we want to leave you all with is to watch this space. And what that means is that disability law is evolving. The law changes both as judges read and interpret cases, new facts come up before them, and those things change the law. Like I said earlier, the Southwest case hinged on the fact that it was an aircraft. Maybe not expressly so, but it that was an important consideration. When a different case came down the pike, the law as we regarded it changed. Also, Congress is always messing with stuff. You know, they don't know when to keep their hands off something, and so they will be changing accessibility law from time to time. They did amend the Rehabilitation Act of 1998. They will certainly at some point.
And they are working on an update to Section 508 again. That's in the works.
Yeah, so they're already changing that. So clearly the law will change over time. So you need to kind of keep abreast on that. The web is changing. You know, new technologies come into play. You know, we've heard of a lot of new technologies this week. You know, if you're using any of the high-end stuff like video or audio or anything like that, or JavaScript, excuse me, you're going to need to know how to implement those accessibly. Your users are using different devices, for example, you know, using things like PDAs to access, you know, iPhones to access websites. So if you need to take into account that when you launch a website, you have to have users not only who are disabled, but also whose devices are different than you might expect, and you want to design for those as well. And then finally, user expectations are changing. You know, when the web first launched, if your website wasn't very useful or wasn't accessible to people, you know, the expectation wasn't necessarily there that it be that way. And so if your website wasn't really very useful, well, nobody really had a website anyway, so they just moved on. Nowadays, people expect more of your business. If you don't have a website, there's something wrong with you. And if your website doesn't work, then there must also be something wrong with you. So, you know, meet your users' expectations, regardless of what level of ability they have or what impairment they might have. So at this point, we're going to go ahead and open it up to any questions. We hope we've been very informative for you. And if you have any questions now, we'll take those now, and we'll be lingering a little bit afterwards as well. Yeah, that's a good point. If you're using web standards, that gets you a lot of the way to where you need to be in the first place. And that'll get you a lot of the way there. Yes.
Yeah, I had a question. We were using the WatchFire accessibility checker for a long time just to spot check our websites. Mm-hmm. And then in the past month or so, I think IBM maybe acquire them, I'm not sure, but anyway, things changed on that site, and you can't access that WatchFire page anymore. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you knew of any other tools out there that you could access to just kind of spot check your accessibility as you're developing.
Yeah, as I mentioned, there's things like the Firefox Accessibility Checker. There's you know, classic things like CynthiaSays.com. You know, there's a variety. I'm sure you could do a quick search and just kind of run through it to see what's out there. It all depends on if it's something that's already publicly out on the web or if it's something that's still within house, you know, on your own private servers.
The nice thing about that checker, mm-hmm, is access.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, on the W3C's web accessibility site, the way there is a list of all the checkers.
So the what's the URL for that?
I don't know it off the top of my head, but if you go to w3.org/way.
W3C.org/WAI?
Yeah.
And it, and you can find it there. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes.
What about the situation for nonprofits or NGOs?
I'm glad you asked. Nonprofits and NGO organizations, if you are based in the United States and you have a place of public accommodation, I think the answer is that you are very likely covered by the ADA because one of the categories is social services. There's no express language that says nonprofits or NGOs, but it depends on what type of public accommodation you're running. It'll vary from organization to organization, but I would say by and large, the fact that you're not a profit organization, you know, you're not seeking profit. Profit has nothing to do with the applicability of the ADA. The test is whether the public uses your physical space. And so I would say that by and large, most nonprofits, most NGOs, if they have places where people come and visit them for any reason, clients or customers or, you know, whatever it is they're doing, they're going to have that issue. And the fact is, even if it's a little bit of a gray area, it's probably better to be safe than sorry. So you want to add anything? Yeah, it's better to be safe than sorry. And if you can be accessible, it's usually a good idea.
Hi, I have two questions. I'm wondering about web developers that provide the service to smaller clients that don't have the knowledge. And, is it possible that the web developers can be considered liable?
That's a good question. I don't believe so. I believe that the liability extends to the place of to the public accommodation itself. Now, could a creative plaintiff's lawyer try and sue everyone involved? Certainly. You know, in the situation you're describing, it doesn't sound like that'd be somebody who is financially attractive as a defendant. But you know, there's the law, and then there's the reality. And you know, is the web developer going to get sued? Probably not, unless the web developer is a pretty big company with good insurance coverage or a lot of money in the bank.
Next question is about the future of captioning on the web, because you know TV is required to provide captioning. What about on the web in the future? What do you think?
Well, in terms of whether the ADA requires that video be captioned, if you're using video technology, or video or audio technology that allows you to caption, I think for example, Flash video now has a built-in feature where you can use closed captioning. Mm-hmm. If you're using that type of technology in your website, you need to use captioning so that the hearing impaired can access the same type of information that any other user could. And if you're not doing that, then you might want to reconsider whether or not it's a useful thing for you to be offering on your website.
Well, one thing that is nice is when you do the captioning and you do have that text equivalent, that that's also something you can make available on your website. And that's something that's indexable, something that's searchable via like a search engine. And that way, you know, you don't have the problem of you have a video, you just have a stream of images and you don't know what's in it. So that is something that's very useful from a search perspective as well. If you do, you know, that might be help present a business case for why to provide captions.
Okay. If you have any questions, by the way, we're forming a line at the mic, so go ahead and come on up. Yes, sir.
Target, this lawsuit has just, you know, that's in the news everywhere. Some of my clients are universities, mm-hmm. and when they come to us with their request proposals, it's very implicit that they want lawsuits to stop coming to them. And the last client, they said this, I'm like, I had no idea that universities are getting sued or getting lawsuits, because it's never in the news, it's never on the headlines. I was just curious if you have any experience or... I mean, is this true?
One thing that you would want to keep in mind, especially if it's a state-run school, is there's usually state laws, and because that means it's tied to the state government and receives the state funding, that means it has to, you know, adhere to those state guidelines. In fact, some states, for example, Kansas, where I worked, they literally took 508, pulled it into their state guidelines on web accessibility, as well as kind of cherry-picked some of the things from the W3C way.
Right.
And brought that in, and the universities, state universities, did have to adhere to those guidelines. So that would be something you might want to look into in each state.
Well, yeah, no, that's
let me say this as well: is that when we're talking about universities, they are covered under the ADA. Talking about being a school, so in terms of wanting the lawsuits to stop, I would think that most universities are pretty well versed in the idea that they need to be accessible generally, and so stopping the lawsuits is a question again.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, how's yes. it going? So assuming Target loses the case or settles, kind of what would you suggest, or what do you think would be an appropriate timeline for a company much larger than Target to begin implementing, accessible web pages?
Right now? I mean, honestly, whether...
Assuming it's a much larger company than Target and it has to go through a lot of red tape.
Yeah. One thing you can start with is just present the case and then present a timeline, a project timeline. Start with maybe the areas of the website that have the most traffic, the most hits, or the most commonly used services that are online. So that would be one approach. The other approach would be go for the low-hanging fruit, the cheap and easy things to fix. Because especially if you make that effort that you're showing, you're going through the steps of trying to make the changes and starting on it, that also builds a lot of good faith as long as you indicate that you're going to finish it eventually. So as I said, go for the easy wins, something cheap. Go for also the things that are highly visible, things that could be, the obvious targets.
So kind of like an iterative release rather than doing everything all at once.
Yeah.
I mean, fix what you can as soon as you can.
Yeah.
The best answer to your question I can give you is fix it before you get sued. The ADA doesn't require that somebody give notice before suing or waiting. There's no time period. The NFB has actually been pretty good about trying to implement policy changes at corporations through negotiation, but there's nothing requiring them to do that. And in fact, a single blind user or somebody with any kind of disability, if they're disgruntled, and they want to file a lawsuit tomorrow against this company that you are discussing, they could, and they would be in immediate peril. So the timeline for when you need to start doing it is very soon. I we're out of time. I'm very sorry that we can't accommodate any more questions, but we will be here for a few more minutes. So thank you all very much for coming.
Thanks.
We really appreciate it, and good luck.